Well, thank you very much, Veery Bodhi, for telling me about your dreams. And I'm very pleased that I can be in your dreams and have so much fun with you rolling around the grass in railway stations. Before I begin my talk, I'd just like to say how moved I am to be here on this occasion, to be talking to so many of you. That, as you can imagine, having come to Sweden in order to start a Buddhist center, and I'll say a little bit about what that was like during the talk, but after 25 years, just being able to come and participate in such a large retreat, and this is large by any standard in the FWBO, anywhere in the world outside of India, probably. So it's... It's not only such a pleasure to be here because, I can't really remember it so long ago that I did something and something else happened, but it's the largest retreat I've ever been on in Sweden, and I think it's the happiest. Or if it's not, I'm the happiest I've ever been on a retreat in Sweden. That it's just such a pleasure being here. And even if it was raining and it was November, I'd still be happy. Just because, assuming that if you all were bright, you know, and could cope with all the greyness of November, it was just such a wonderful thing. So thank you very, very much for making it possible for me to be here with so many of you on this occasion. I was just about to look at my notes just now, just before I came here. And I noticed I'd written something down from a talk that I attended in Manchester, given by Ratnaguna, or a series of talks given by Ratnaguna, some months ago. And it was a poem, and I've got absolutely no idea where it comes from, but it just seemed very appropriate, little verse, to call. In fact, I like to call my talk this little verse, okay? Because in some ways it's quite pertinent to me, it's quite to the point. Time to fall is time to float for a lotus blossom. Time to fall is time to float for a lotus blossom. Okay, so it was on a sometime in February in 1980. Long time ago, before some of you were born, I think. she's a bit worried. I finally decided that I was going to come to Sweden and try to set up a Buddhist center. I'd visited Sweden twice previously, in the summer of 1978 and 1979, and it was to a very, very beautiful retreat centre in Småland that was owned by the only Swedish order member that existed at the time, Arya Vamsa, who's still with us, and I think he'll be possibly coming next Saturday to our celebration. And it was a smaller version of this, much smaller version of this, but there was a lake and it was beautiful weather, July, and I fell in love with Sweden. And I came to Stockholm in 1979 in order to... I'm just giving myself a mental note. I'm going to start reminiscing, right? And I've got to keep getting back to the talk, so... I'm going to have to keep reminding. So if I look a bit confused, that's what I'm doing. I think there's a little voice saying, get back to the talk. So anyway, I came to Stockholm and... I happened to say to another friend, Robert Carlison, who I hope may be at the festival next week as well, that I could really imagine living here in Stockholm. It was a beautiful summer's week I spent in Stockholm, and I really fell in love with the place. But I wasn't stupid, not totally. I knew that Sweden in the summer was probably very different to Sweden in the winter, so I came back in February just to check it out. And if you weren't born at that time, right, or you were very young, you might not realise that in the early 1980s, Sweden, Stockholm, experienced very cold winters. they were never green, they were always white. And Mälaren always froze, and the sea out here always froze. It was a beautiful, you know, cold winters, and I loved it. And I stayed with Robert's mother, who's probably passed on by now, and for 3 weeks, and I run some courses here, and there was quite a good response. So I decided to come to Sweden. I'm not going to tell you what happened during the course of those 8 years that I spent in Sweden setting up the centre. It was just under 8 years that I was here. In some ways, not a lot happened in an external sense, and in other ways, you know, things did happen. Maybe it's enough to say that it was a bit like sowing a seed or some seeds from which things have grown. And the seeds that I sown seem to bear very little relation to the blossom that we see here today. But seeds are like that, aren't they? You know, you hold a seed and then you see a blossom and you think, how did this get to that? So the causal relationship is a bit of a strange thing. But what I want to talk about is why I came to Sweden. In fact, I've been pondering this point probably on and off ever since I came for 25 years. It's good to just say that on the whole, although the 8 years I spent here weren't always easy, they were very, very rich years for me. I was in my early 30s when I came to Sweden, and it was a very, very formative period in my life. So what happened to me in those 8 years seems to have formed me in many ways, which has sort of stood me in stead for the rest of my life, if you understand what I mean. It was a sort of a forming process. So it was quite a difficult time, but I learned so many things. I came into contact with so many wonderful people, and I felt as though I was reborn, if you like. There was a sort of, I think they say when you learn a new language, you acquire a new soul. And it took me a long time to learn to speak Swedish. You know, I don't speak it very well, but it took a long time, and didn't come very easy, and everyone wanted to speak English to me. But I started feeling that once I started being here and feeling, getting a feel for the language, I also got a feel for what it might be like to be Swedish. And I always feel very, very much at home when I'm with Swedes. In fact, I feel more at home when I'm with Swedes usually than when I'm with the English. Sorry, guys. So, yeah, why did I move here? Well, I don't think it was just the summers, because they're very short, and, you know, as beautiful as they are, it can be very changeable. It's not sunny every day. And the winters are all right, but they're a little bit too long. I love you. I love Swedish people. I found it very easy to make friends with people here in Sweden, even though at first, you know, being English, used to find Swedes rather reserved, a bit shy, but when I realised actually you're not really, you're very, you know, sort of fun-loving, friendly people. But that wasn't really the reason that brought me. I acquired a love of nature, particularly through my friends helping me to understand the sort of relationship that Swedes have with nature, which, having been born in London, I had no idea what they were talking about. But I gradually acquired that sense. It could have been it could have been for any of these reasons, really. It could have been just that I wanted an adventure. My life had been sort of fairly sheltered, I suppose, living in England. I hadn't travelled very much, and it all seemed to be settling down in a way that made me feel slightly claustrophobic. So there was part of me wanted to break out and do something else. So I could have come for personal reasons. And it may have just been that I liked a challenge. I wanted to do something that was a bit like hopping into a fire. When I think back now on what I did, it did seem a little rather remarkable, if not stupid. I couldn't speak Swedish. I had hardly any friends here. I had a very tenuous idea of how I was going to be supported. I had no work permit. I had a permit to be here. This was just for case you're very young. This was before Sweden was in the European Union. And so I thought, oh, I'll just go somewhere on my own where I can't speak the language and just set up a Buddhist center in a culture that was sort of rather strange and unfamiliar. So it could have been that reason. But I had in the back of my mind all the time that I was coming here to set up a Buddhist center, and it was very, very important to me that I set up this Buddhist center. But I really don't know why. When I look at my motives, there are all sorts of motives. I just want to mention that it wasn't the usual motive that English people move to Sweden. Do you know what that is, don't you? You know, you meet a Swedish, you know, and then you get married, and you know, that might have happened later, but that wasn't the reason I came here. And so I've just been wondering, you know, why was it I took this leap into what was for me quite a challenging, dangerous situation. I'm not sure I know, actually. I'm just going to explore this with you, because I'm the sort of person who likes to think aloud. Maybe by the end of the talk I might have some answers. if you're still awake. just to give you a little bit of background information, though, that there was a sort of culture at the time that I was very much influenced by within the FWO, within the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. That I'd been ordained into the Western Buddhist Order in 1974, in August 1974, which makes me 31 as an order member, 31 years in the order. And there was a culture beginning to develop shortly after I was ordained of expansion, that there were a few centres in England, one in Scotland, and there was a sense of expansion. I think it was in 1972. Two Finnish order members came from England and started centre in Helsinki, and one or more went to New Zealand to start centre. But several of my friends went off to distant places. A friend of mine went off to India to start activities there, and another friend several friends went to the United States to start activities there. But I chose Sweden. Sort of rather strange place to come if you're English, and people might say, well, why are you going to Sweden? And isn't it a bit boring? It's a bit flat, isn't it? And aren't Swedes a bit boring? And some of my sort of men friends used to dig me in the ribs. We say, yeah, we know why you're going to Sweden. So it was a sort of a bit of a mystery to everyone else why I was going to Sweden too. I remember once. God, this is my mind. I remember once reading or hearing on a news program, Sweden was the most undiscovered place to go to. Like tourism, you know, fortunately never discovered Sweden. Maybe unfortunately for the economy, but fortunate to keep everything unspoilt. And so I hope it doesn't, you know, become well known. But maybe I got caught up in this personal culture. And it was something to do with a bodhisattva spirit. It was either the Bodhisattva spirit or the Cold War. Do you remember the Cold War? The Cold War, in case you're too young to remember, the Cold War was the war between America and Russia that never really took place. But it was just a constant proliferation of one bloc building more weapons than the other, and then the other bloc building more. And there was, I grew up, I suppose, with this fear that the whole of civilization, as I knew it, was going to be blown to pieces. And I thought Sweden would be a sort of a place you could disappear in. I thought I hadn't realised it was quite close to Russia. And maybe a Pacific island would have been more suitable. But I thought, you know, you could take the Dharma somewhere to sort of, as it were, safeguard it, just in case the rest of the world blew itself up And so I must have had some sort of strange idea that I was special. I was going to safeguard the Dharma, just in case. But in all seriousness, I would like to say that one of the reasons why I joined the Western Buddhist Order, I don't want to go into why I was a Buddhist, take too long. But one of the reasons it was very important for me to join a collection of individuals was that back in those days we had this idea that if you could get enough people to change their mind, you could change the world. And funnily enough, I discovered this is what ecology is thinking these days, that there's a sort of a growing idea these days. If you can get enough people to change their consciousness, you'd be able to change the world. So it was very, very important to me, for some reason, to change the world. I wanted to not just change the world, I wanted to make the world a better place to live in. And so I was looking for a way of making a difference and being part of a sort of a group of people that could somehow make a difference to people's lives, to society, and so on. So there I was, I suppose, on a mission. Change the world, go to Sweden. And it just sort of seems so ridiculous now. So you can understand why I was asking these questions. But before all this happened, just to tell you what it was like for me being an order member, when I joined the order, it was very, very small. There was probably about 40, 50, maybe 60 order members. And the week after I was ordained on a family retreat, or retreat, you know, where there were families, I went to an order meeting. And one of the things I noticed in this order meeting is that order members seem to like arguing with each other. Now, I don't think that happens in Sweden, so you've got rather an unusual order here. But I can assure you, in many other centres, order members go through periods where they fall out with each other. Anyway, I thought it was very normal for order members just to argue. And being of an argumentative temperament, I just thought it was great fun, you know, just telling everyone how awful they were. And, you know, like, you never get up in the morning, do you? You know, and just really laying into people. And I realised after a while some people found it very painful. But one of the things I noticed was that when I was with order members, I had a sense of something being there. And I can't even say it's something being there. It was a sense of something that made being an order member very, very special to me. It was as though, and in a way, this is what I want to explore in the talk, so you have to hold this. It's the sort of this experience I had made it very, very important for me to be an order member. It's as though something new was coming into existence, which I kept catching a glimpse of. You know, it's like sometimes you see something out the corner of your eye, and when you turn, it's not there. And it was like that all the time. It was as I kept catching glimpses of something, but I couldn't pin it down. So I found it really amazing experience being with order members, and then I felt, well, being part of the order at that time meant going off and doing something as an order member. In fact, I think we used to give each other a hard time if you didn't do this. You know, if you were someone that didn't do very much, like starting a centre or running a centre or something, usually you got told. In fact, one order member told me he thought I was a bit of a playboy. You know, all I did just want to have fun, which is true. But I sort of, maybe that was something that got me to come here. Is I thought, well, I'll show him. I'll go and do something a bit different. So I came to Sweden and embarked upon being a playboy, I suppose. But that's not really what happened in Sweden. I came to Sweden, just to fill you in a quick little bit on what happened. And very quickly, I felt there was a lot of interest. I think the first course I went to, which we run near Hunstall in Stockholm, there were about, I think Arika was there, who's 17, at that course. I think there were about 25 people one night, and it was the beginning of a course, and I thought, wow, this is going to be so easy. You know, just the first, you know, little bit of publicity, you get 25 people out of a pop, you know, there was only like a million people lived in Greater Stockholm then, so I thought, oh, that's pretty good, you know. So just get going. And then I met another person called Kennett, who later became Dhirananda. And within a few months, I had a men's community going, three mitras, And someone well on the way to being an order member who was ordained a couple of years later. So I think, wow, yes, it's pretty easy. You know, I could you know, do this with my eyes closed, as it were. Anyway, reality hit me after that. I was trying to learn Swedish, and then things just became more and more difficult. The 80s, and for those of you who didn't live through them, and for those of you who did and have forgotten, were times when, at the beginning of the 80s, this is my subjective experience, but I think it's objective. There was a lot of interest in spiritual groups, and then suddenly there wasn't. You remember there was that Rajneesh scandal. You know, suddenly spiritual things were, you know, really suspect, and cult, you know, and people stopped coming to classes. So I'd sometimes prepare a talk, and one person would come. It was very, very frustrating. In fact, it was easier when no one came, because then I could just go home or go and have a beer or something, just to sort of feel sorry for myself. But, you know, when one person came, I had to give the talk. And anyway, I gradually collected around me a group of people who liked arguing. I think the ones that didn't like arguing used to hang out with Dhirananda and a few other friends who were very, very nice and friendly. I'd like to apologise to all those people. Fortunately, very few of you are here. Virya Bodhi was very intelligent. He went off to England. But I think I must, and Ola kept, sorry, he was Ola in those days, but Arika, he kept sort of coming and going. You know, he'd come along to classes and he'd be really enthusiastic. And you wouldn't see him for months. In fact, you wouldn't even see him for years sometimes. And then he'd come back again. And the only reason I can put this down to is the fact I was giving people too hard a time. That at the time, because I wanted to start a centre, I expected everyone else to join in with it. And so I wanted everyone else to build the centre with me and to live in communities and to start up businesses. And if they didn't, I wasn't interested. Well, I sort of was, but, you know, the message I gave was, well, you're not a real person if you're not going to do that. So any of you who were here, and I think you know who you are, I'd like to apologise for any hard times I gave you for not helping me to build the centre. But it's very important, this, because in some ways I think I was a bit manipulative. You know, when you've got this idea in your mind you're going to change the world, you're sort of a bit prepared for casualties, aren't you? You sort of think, well, just get a few people involved, and if they drop out, you don't really think like this, but, you know, it's sort of probably that's what's happening. You think, well, it doesn't matter because they've done something, and it would just be for the greater good. And at some point in my life, I realised this wasn't really on, that it actually wasn't really very much in accordance with Buddhism. And I think I came to Sweden probably with some suspect motives. But I like to think there was an element of the Bodhisattva spirit there, that I wanted to actually share the Dharma with everyone. And I really believed the Dharma was good for people. And it was a bit like, you know, force-feeding ducks or something, and putting a tube down their throat and then pushing the food down. And, of course, some people choked and run away. So, you know, I had this feeling, and I don't think I was alone, unfortunately. This is the worst thing, is that we did set up a lot of centres with this bit of an attitude of, you know, let's just get something going and, you know, whatever, and we just get something going. And we did get a lot of things going, but I think we actually left a few people sort of a bit damaged, perhaps, a bit disappointed, let's say, on the way. So it's something I felt quite unhappy about. Anyway, I didn't start a centre. I started an organisation. I was doing quite a lot of classes. And I ran out of steam. I ran out of inspiration. I really didn't know why I was here any longer. And I felt a time had come to sort of refresh my inspiration and find another way of doing things. And So I left Sweden, and Dhirananda took over. And during the next few years, I and Ulrika, we used to come back to Sweden quite often, and Ratnaprabha came and I think a few other people. And we helped to keep the centre. We actually helped to renovate to renovate the centre in what's it called? Södermalms Gatan. Is that right? It's been such a long time I've been there. And we came back, and Arika, who was not an order member, he wasn't even a Mitra then, but he was around, and rather courageously offered to keep things running. And things ticked over until Sataraja and Priyadarshan came, and after that there was a blossoming. It was as though, you know, something had been planted. Arika had helped it to grow, and we were trying to give it as much support as possible from outside. And then there came a period when Sataraja and Priyadarshan was here, where everything just started to grow much more quickly, and now we see the blossom of what's happened here. I left Sweden and went to back to England. I was invited to go and join an ordination team, a men's ordination team. And I carried on working there for 8 years. And during that time, I had this idea that if I could help people to become order members, there were more and more order members, there was a good chance still, because I still had this idea of changing the world, that the more order members there were, spreading the Dharma to as many different places as possible, there was a good way, a good chance of getting people to change their consciousness and change the world. And at times during that process, when certainly in, to start with, when I was just ordaining or involved in helping a few people be ordained, to get ordained, I really did wonder whether this was going to work. And I think over the 8 years that I lived at Padmaloka in England, working with the men's ordination process, I gradually lost faith in the fact that the order, the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, would really change the world. And I began to even question whether I'd been thinking in the right way. So a whole sort of process started taking place in me that made me question all the things that I'd done before. I then spent the last, in fact, just the last 5 years working in quite a central part of the movement, living in Birmingham, working with other senior order members, going to many different places to help people get ordained still, and just helping order members. And I think gradually the whole order, the whole movement, has gone through some sort of crisis even of faith, and the idea that the Bodhisattva spirit, the ideal, was to spread the Dharma by setting up centers, I think has been questioned, and a lot of people have perhaps lost confidence in it, or at least in it as a in the method that was being used in propagating in developing the Dharma. So gradually, I noticed that my life was reaching something of a crisis. And one of the reasons why I wanted to mention that poem at the beginning, because Ratnaguna, when he gave his talk in Manchester, he was talking about a number of masters from the Pure Land School. And it seems as though in the most of the masters in the Pure Land School, before they became enlightened, had a serious crisis. There was something where they got to a point where they just could not go on anymore. And they realized that all their own efforts of making an effort to gain enlightenment ultimately would not be possible. There's a sort of logic to this, that if you think you can, by your own efforts, can gain enlightenment, you don't really understand what enlightenment is. And once you do understand what enlightenment is, you realize you can't make an effort to get there. It's too complicated, perhaps, to explain. But there comes a point, and certainly within the Pure Land School, where you realize you can't do it on your own. And the masters went through a sense that there's no way to gain enlightenment on your own. All you can do is rely on the Buddha or Amitabha. And anyway, I don't want to get into a talk about the Pure Land School. But it was shortly, it was actually a couple of years before this, about 3 years ago, that I went through a bit of a crisis myself. And something happened to me that seemed to change my whole perspective on what I was doing as an order member. So in some ways, although it was a very short period, it happened just within a few days, and then it seemed to go over. Something happened to me during that time that made a very, very big difference. And it's, in a way, it's changed the whole course of my life since then, for the last 3 years. What happened was I decided to go on a solitary retreat. So I thought, you know, I'll rent a cottage. I had enough money to rent a nice sort of comfortable cottage, like a stuga, you know, in Wales. And I'd been to one before, and I thought, yeah, that was really nice. And I tried to go there again. It had a beautiful view across the sea to Anglesey. You know, there was a castle down the bottom, and there was a mountain behind. And I thought, this would be a great place to have a solitary retreat. Unfortunately, I couldn't get that place, so I booked another one. And it hadn't quite sort of clicked for me that this other one was a lodge. Now, a lodge is what you have as like a gatehouse. It's a house. You know, England and Wales have country estates, you know, big manor houses. Do you know sort of things? You ever seen a film like Sense and Sensibility, Jane Austen? You know, these big country. Well, each of those would have a gatehouse at the gate, right? So where do you put gatehouses? Where is the gate normally? It's on a road, isn't it? Yeah. So I'd booked this lovely, it had a wonderful description in this book of this cottage that was actually on a road. Now, it wasn't on a small road, it was on a big road. It was on one of the main roads in Wales. And it was only when I went to see it, to just a few days before I was going to go there for 10 days or two, it was a week, I can't remember now. Anyway, I was going to go there for, you know, quite a few days, and my heart sank, and for some perverse reason, I didn't try to change it. I just almost like whipped myself by going there. So I went to this solitary retreat on this main road. it was a bit like actually being on a roundabout. In fact, the road went round the house. And I think all night long and all day there were lorries and cars going past. I mean, it wasn't a highway. It was just a, you know, two lanes of roads, but it was like with trains of traffic going past. Anyway, so I sort of, my heart sank, and I thought, well, no, I'll get up and meditate. So I got up, put my earplugs in, and sat and meditated. And I decided I was going to really make an effort to, you know, prove. This is sort of a pattern emerging for me now. I came to Sweden, and now I'm doing a solitary retreat on a main road. So I meditated in the mornings, and I was getting deeper and deeper into my meditation. And I think there was part of me just feeling sorry for myself. You know, I'd really been looking forward to this solitary retreat, and it was on a main road. But I went for long walks, and actually the upside was it was a very beautiful countryside, lots of woods, and it was cold, and there was snow on the mountains, and it was very, very beautiful. And what I practiced doing was being present in the moment. And I'd read this book called The Breathing Book, and there was something in there, I think by Thich Nhat Hanh, actually, and I can't even remember what it was now, but I kept saying it to myself. You know, when you breathe in something, and when you breathe out something, and it was all to do with being in the present moment. So I was walking, going on walks, breathing in, breathing out, and being in the present moment. And this started having a very, very big effect on me. And I've been meditating for so many years. I don't usually find it too difficult to meditate these days. So I was sitting and having quite settled, absorbed meditations in the morning. And so one day I was sitting there, and I was thinking about reality, as one does in solitary retreats, and thinking about mind. I've always been interested in mind, and I've always tried to watch my mind. And so I started watching my mind. And then I realized that my mind was producing ideas non-stop. In Buddhism, there's a term for this in Sanskrit. It's called prapancha. It's a proliferation, is that right? It's proliferation of mental events. And I was watching my mind just proliferate. This is a good word, proliferate. It's what the Russians and the Americans did with missiles. They proliferated. So one would build one lot, and then the next lot would build an even bigger lot. So it's like thoughts proliferate. You know, you have one thought, and then that sets off a chain of other thoughts, which sets off a chain of other thoughts, and you get a chain reaction and a nuclear explosion later on. Anyway, I had a sort of nuclear explosion. I suddenly realized, and this might not mean very much to anyone, but I realized that there was no way of ever seeing reality, because as soon as you thought about reality, you were in prapancha, you were proliferating. It was an idea. You know, enlightenment was suddenly an idea. And then you thought, oh, the enlightened state is this, this, and this. And you had more ideas. And then you think, how'd you get there? You had more ideas. And I suddenly saw all this very, very clearly. And I got totally depressed. I felt there was absolutely no way out of samsara, because whatever you did, it was proliferation of mental events. And I always feel slightly embarrassed talking about this, but I'm going to tell you, I'm going to share this with you, and I hope you're not shocked, but I got so depressed, I thought, well, not actually depressed, I was despondent. I just thought, well, you had no hope. There was no hope anymore. I thought, you can't change the world, you can't even change yourself, because whatever you try to do, it's just another idea. It's simply an idea. There's nothing else to do. So I turned, there was a TV there. And I was a bit tempted with this TV because of the lorries and things, feeling sorry for myself. So I turned it on. Well, actually, what it is, I went into town and bought myself a bottle of wine, came back, cooked a meal, had a few glasses of wine, turned the TV on, because I decided it was as good watching TV, drinking a glass of wine, as meditating. It was absolutely, you know, as soon as you started thinking meditation was better, prapancha. Drinking wine, prapancha. What was the difference? There was no difference. It was the same. What did I enjoy more? Watching TV, drinking a glass of wine. So I sat there and I watched a few movies, which included a James Bond movie. But there was one movie there that must have been sent by the gods or the Bodhisattvas. It was a movie that some of you may have seen it, but it's an English-American movie. It's a movie that's called The Long Goodbye with Emma Thompson in it. And if you haven't seen it, it's basically a story of this English professor whose speciality is a poem called Death Be Not Proud. It's an English poem from medieval times. And to cut a long story short, in this monologue, it's a sort of there's very little happens in this film. Basically, this woman's dying, and she's talking about dying of cancer, and it's just a long goodbye. It's all about her talking, and it's quite funny actually in places. It's a sort of a black comedy, and what I felt from this film, something that really moved me. She had no friends. She was English. She was in an American hospital. She was quite well off, you know, nice room, and one person, the nurse, was just slightly friendly but keeping boundaries, and I felt very moved by this, and I thought how awful it must be to be rich, well off, have all the support things and have no friends, and I started reflecting on this and I just left it, and then I started thinking, well, I'm not in a very good mental state. Here I am watching TV, drinking wine. I probably wasn't thinking this when I was drinking the wine, but probably the next day I was thinking, I don't know if I want to go on living my life watching TV and drinking wine. So I thought, I'm not in a very good mental state, so how can I get out of this mental state? And I thought, well, if you start thinking about it, you're just going to get back into the problem prapancha. You're just going to, you know, have more thoughts. So I sort of tried to sit with my experience, which is a bit unusual for a bloke, you know, to know what you're feeling and sort of sit there feeling what you're feeling. And then gradually I realised that the most important thing to me in my life was caring about people. You know, when I thought of, you know, friends, family, and I realised that I actually care, I felt moved. I felt a sort of a welling up of energy as though it could make me do something. And I started reflecting on this and I came to the conclusion that the only way to enlightenment is by caring. So I became a carer. I decided from that moment on that I was going to start dedicating my life to caring about people and not try and change the world. And from that time, although I watch my mind producing ideas all the time, of course, I know deep down that there's something else that you can't deconstruct with your thoughts. There's something real. I think Schopenhauer said that you see the world as just ideas and reflections, but you know when you're thirsty. You know, thirstiness, when you want to drink, is real. You know that. And it was a bit like that experience. I knew that I could care, and I was in touch with that feeling of kindness, and I felt if I could build on that, something would take me somewhere. And I've been reflecting on this ever since. So from that point on, I really have just been looking for ways in which to care for people. Sangha Akshita, when I came back from this solitary retreat, was ill. And funnily enough, he needed a lot of caring. And I was living in the same house with him. And I'm sort of a person that he's relied on in times of difficulties, you know, like when he needed someone to drive him somewhere or, you know, make sure he had enough money or something like that. And I've always felt a very warm friendliness. And although I've never been like a personally very close friend to Sangha Akshita, I have sort of an ease with him. And I know he trusts me. And so I started spending time with him. He was suffering from sleep deprivation. And he got in a terrible state of, you know, sleeping 2 or 3 hours a night, sometimes not at all. And he needed someone to be there with him. And just to keep him company help him do things. So I started spending nights sleeping in his flat in the room next door, and sometimes he'd wake me up in the middle of the night, and so I was getting sleep deprivation. And I found it really hard. I mean, if any of you have looked after an old family member, you know what I'm talking about. It's very, very difficult looking after an older person who wants things in a particular way. You know, and you say, no, you don't need it that way. And you say, end of story, they want it that way, so it has to be that way. And you think, oh, God. And so this idea of caring, I realised, was a really, like, a tantric path. It wasn't easy. And it meant really putting other people, in front of your own personal likes and dislikes. So later on, I started working with Ratnaguna and Vidyamala in pain management, helping people manage chronic pain, and other groups of people working with a lot of stress. And I think what I realised is that was important for me. It was not only just caring for people, but I was looking for a team to work with. And really this is what I want to end my talk about on, really. Many years ago, 1994, I was on an ordination course, 16-week ordination course. And on that course, we had a choir. And I probably told some of you this in talks, but I'm going to tell you again, sorry. That was a very seminal experience for me. I sang in this choir. I've never sung before in my life, and I sang in this choir. And there was a moment when we were singing where I had a sort of that moment of, oh, you know, where you just sort of felt as though you were lifted out of yourself. And I realised that when you sing in choirs and it all goes well, there is something comes into being that's greater than the sum of the parts. You know, if you sort of try to analyse what it is by taking all the parts and saying, is it this, is it this, is it this, is it this, you don't find it. It's something new comes into existence. And that gave me a clue to what it was I was looking for. And what I've been looking for all my life is something that emerges within a situation that is not there just if you look at the parts. It's only when all those parts come together in a certain way that something new erupts into being and you discover it. And this sort of reminded me of this thing that kept going out of my vision when I first was ordained, that there was this sense there was something there, but when you look for it, it disappeared. And I really believe that this is what the bodhicitta is. That when people come together and they do something together, something can erupt into being. And one of the elements, one of the parts that perhaps needs to be necessary is this attitude of caring, of this altruistic dimension, this attitude that other people are important. They're as important as you are, if not, well, equally important as you are. People are special. You're not the only person that's special. Other people are special. If there is that attitude there when you come together, then this bodhicitta, this will to enlightenment seems to, or something erupts, and it would only be sort of like thoughts and labels and things to call it bodhicitta. But if I was to say what bodhicitta means to me, it's this mysterious thing, this X factor, that erupts in when a group of people come together. So I realized perhaps what I was looking for when I came to Sweden with building this center was the bodhicitta erupting. And I was getting a group of people together. I knew you had to have a group of people, even in those days, to allow the bodhicitta to erupt. What I hadn't realized is it doesn't erupt if you whip people. You know, if you whip people into being together, nothing happens. People all need to be there on an equal basis with the same sense of wonder and joy and spirit, like being in a choir, where you're not being forced to be there, but you just want to be there because you love singing. And so I suddenly started seeing the Sangha in a different way. I just wished I'd come to Sweden to start a choir now. A Buddhist choir, if you see what I mean. I mean, I couldn't sing, I can't read music. But if I'd come to Sweden with this idea that I didn't need to build a Sangha, I just needed to get a group of people together to sing. And in singing together, something would come into being. And this is what I think Sangha is. And this is all I want Sangha to be nowadays. I just want people to care about one another. I don't care how many centres we have anymore. And it's lovely being here on such a big retreat. But I would hate it if we thought this was something that we have to have. We have to build on this. What I like about this retreat so far, it seems like everyone wants to be here. Because you all like singing, so to speak. You like just being together, practicing meditation together, doing things together. And I can feel it. Something is coming into being, can't you? It's as though we're all participating in this wonderful thing. And when we go away, it won't be there. There will be a memory of it. And when we come back together again, we'll plug into it again. And this is all I want to do for the rest of my life, is sing with you, so to speak, to practice with you, to be with you. That could be building centres, although I'm getting a bit old for that now. But that would be one thing to do. But it doesn't have to be the only thing. Just having meditation retreats. In England, it's taken me, I was very, very resistant against this. There's a retreat called a Buddhafield retreat, which I thought was just a load of reactive hippies doing this retreat. But actually, I've come to think it's probably one of the best things that's happened in the FWBO ever, that people come together, 2,000 people come together in the summer with children, teenagers, pensioners. Everyone's there just having a fantastic sing, so to speak, you know, practicing together. And they all can participate and have a sense of the Dharma, the sense of the bodhicitta. And they really care about one another. Not everyone all the time, but that spirit of being looked after is there. So I hope that from now on, the FWBO will just be really like a choir, and that we'll all be able to participate in that mysterious thing that erupts into being. I hope that there will be many, many occasions when you can come together, and maybe I can come and join you on retreat or in the centre practicing together, where we can all allow the bodhicitta to emerge in our midst, and we can all be, for a short while at least, bodhisattvas. So that's what the bodhisattva ideal means to me today. I felt as though I was a lotus when I came here. I thought I was special. And then I fell. And now I'm enjoying floating.